Pretty much everybody gets a bruise at one time or another, and pretty often those bruises are kind of inconsequential, but there are often times when bruises can be a sign of something serious. So we'll be talking about how to know when it may be time to see a medical professional when you have a bruise. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our physical therapist back with us again to talk about bruises and why they can be serious, and also to answer your other physical therapy questions as well. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum. Jill, good to see you.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, Lori Tyne-Brody, thank you for coming by as well.
Great to be here.
Jill is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, and Lori is a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW-Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Do you have a bruise that you might be concerned about? Maybe you've got some physical therapy questions you'd like to ask. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Jill and Lori, you know, we've talked about all kinds of things over the years on this show, and I can't remember ever talking about bruises.
Well, many people think that bruises are inconsequential, or that, oh, I have this and it's going to go away. And they don't necessarily realize or understand the impact or the ramification that bruising can have, whether it's on soft tissue, your muscles, things like that, or if it's actually what we call a bone bruise. And those are actually very, very different.
Bruises come in a lot of sizes, shapes, and often many colors. As Jill alluded to, there are deep bone bruises that happen, for example, most often associated with the tear to your anterior cruciate ligament. There are deep muscle bruises that happen, for example, to your quadriceps or the biceps in your arm, that are usually the result of a blow. So we see them in football, we see them in
hockey
or baseball, where you're hit with a fast-moving hard object. And in those cases, you often don't see bruising on the skin, which is what's so deceiving, but it's a deep muscle bruise that's actually a very serious situation. And then you have your garden variety superficial bruise that happens when you bump something. But as Jill said, realize you bump something hard enough to cause some damage, and there could be damage to some of the soft tissue underneath the skin there.
Right.
I've had some bruises that were wild colors. They turn different colors.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's not uncommon, especially as blood runs or pools against gravity. So many times you'll see, so if somebody sprains their ankle per se and they injure a ligament or the muscles around the ankle, what you'll see, because that foot is in a gravity dependent position, is that blood or the damage will run distally and kind of sit in what we call a fascial plane. So where your connective tissue kind of runs in different angles, and you'll see blood kind of sit and pool there, and without a muscle contraction or any way to kind of pump that fluid away, it'll just sit there, become stagnant, and then that's when you get those nice variety of colors.
Yeah.
You'll also see that kind of, and you say bleeding / bruising when you have a big trauma, like an ankle sprain. The other situation you get that is with a muscle rupture.
Right.
So if you have, the classic we see is a hamstring rupture, and then you'll have bleeding all the way down the back of the thigh.
Right. And yes, and so pretty then, colors.
And so then you get also some swelling.
Right. So typically, I mean, there's an inflammatory process that occurs with all of this, and your body responds appropriately to kind of, it has to go through this entire kind of process or this inflammatory cycle, and it kind of sends in different structures to kind of clean up. And that whole process takes a few days. For some people, it takes longer. It takes weeks, depending on the health of the joint, your overall physical health and well-being, your blood supply, how well you manage or take care of the injury. So it used to be traditionally that anytime you had a bruise or swelling, you were told to ice it for 24 to 48 hours, and then you were classically told to switch to heat. And that is not necessarily the case. We used to think that everyone kind of went through the first stages of the inflammatory cycle in 48 hours. And what we know now is that your comorbidities play a significant role in that. And not everybody goes through those first phases of the inflammatory response cycle in the same time. So you need to pay a little bit more attention to how your body is responding to the condition and treat that, not necessarily go by the cookbook or the textbook of, oh, it's been 2 days since my bruise came on, I should switch from ice to heat.
And generally, if you're having that much bruising,
right,
you should be consulting a medical practitioner to help give you some guidance and make sure that there isn't some other kind of intervention you should be considering at that point.
So what does cold do and what does heat do?
So that's a great question. So cold is actually vasoconstrictive, and it decreases the blood flow to the area as opposed to heat, which it causes an increase in blood flow to the area. So acutely, you don't want to have a big rush of blood to that area, increase circulation to that area, because the theory behind it is you'll bring in blood and then it will sit there. So the theory is you kind of want to discourage a lot of blood flow from the area to kind of stop all of that from rushing in. When the time is right, you do want to increase blood flow to the area because you want blood flow to kind of circulate and kind of flush out the bad stuff.
Oh.
And so there is a purpose for each of them. It's all a matter of how you put the timing in with regards to the acuity of the injury.
Right. And in terms of increasing the blood flow to the area, at that point, there may be other alternative ways to increase blood flow
right.
that are better for the healing,
right?
Depending upon the severity of the injury. So a severe injury, yes, potentially heat. And a less severe injury, you may actually start moving it to increase mm-hmm. the circulation to the area and actually mechanically move some of that fluid out of there.
And one of the things Lori touched on earlier was a bone bruise.
Yeah.
And when you have a high energy trauma or mechanism of injury, you may very well see a bone bruise. And bone bruises have really been around for a long time. We didn't realize they were there until the advent of MRI. But the ACL, when you tear your ACL in your knee, that's kind of a classic example. What happens is your femur and tibia hit together and compress very rapidly, very high energy, and you actually create bruising within the bone, which leads to kind of a low-grade, prolonged, dull ache, which can last up to 6 months. Some people, it lasts up to a year. And on MRI, it'll show up as increased signal uptake in the bones, and so we know that it is there.
So when should we be concerned?
Well, obviously, if you have a severe injury where right. you can't weight bear on it, if it's a lower extremity, if it's an upper extremity problem, you can't move or use your arm, obviously, that's a situation where you need to see somebody right away. If you're seeing a lot of bruising or bleeding in the area, you need to see that. To see somebody for that. If you just bump something and you see a bruise on your skin, but you can still use your limb, you can still activate the muscles, you just have a bruise on your skin, that's not something I would seek help for.
The other thing is knowing if your medications affect this. So if you are anticoagulated take a medication that increases, it thins out your blood, you may bruise more easily.
All the time, yep.
And so what may be normal for you may be abnormal for somebody else. So you have to also understand how your medications could impact your bruising.
And you yep. should be talking with your doctor about that.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
absolutely.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, let's take some calls. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Mary Lou in Monroe, we'll go to you first. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. The last 2 weeks in December, we went on vacation, and we were actually in Europe, so that involved a lot of walking. My 16-year-old daughter lugged her backpack along with her oftentimes, and then also sometimes we were pulling some really heavy suitcases. She has been complaining now, ever since we got back, about a soreness in her right shoulder blade, and I'm thinking it's just from hauling the suitcase around and it's going to go away. Is it something I should just let go away, or is it symptomatic of maybe something worse?
Well, that's a great question. So when she was lugging her backpack around, did she just throw it over her right shoulder? Did she have it distributed evenly over both shoulders, Mary Lou?
She did both.
Okay, she did a little bit of both. Okay, and when she was lugging her suitcases, was that primarily in her right shoulder or her right arm?
It sure was.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, shoulder blade pain is a little bit different than pain that's on top of your shoulder. So pain that's around your shoulder blade can be coming either from your cervical spine, your lower cervical, or it can be coming from your upper back spine. It can be just your garden variety muscle tightness. But the fact that it's still going on at least 2 or 3 weeks after the conclusion of your trip, and unless she's doing something that's very right-hand dominant or still carrying around a heavy backpack, I would say she should see somebody for it. She may just need a couple of exercises to get her back on track. But we also see this kind of pattern in people who are hypermobile, and she could have a rib issue there, or something in her thoracic spine that needs to be addressed. So given that it's been going on this long, I'd have her see somebody and just check it out and see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good luck, Mary Lou. Thanks for calling. Kenneth was wondering about the differences between bruises and the dark red spots that some elderly people have. Are those bruises as well?
Some of them can be bruises, but some of them are just age-related spots that are changes in the dermatome or the epidermis of the skin. So some of them may be bruises. Elderly people do have a tendency to bruise a little bit more easily, especially if they're anticoagulated or on warfarin, heparin, something like that. But some of the just kind of red spots that you see that are there all the time and present or all the time are skin-related aging changes within the epidermis.
And their skin is thinner, too, than a younger person. So if they do bruise, it may show up a little bit darker or last a bit longer.
Right.
Linda in Hazel Green, we turn to you now. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about my 16-year-old grandson who was injured in football. He injured his shoulder, had an MRI, and found out that he has all loose joints, and wondered and is possibly going to be fitted for a brace and have quite a bit of physical therapy, and wondered if you had any advice.
Right. Well, the fact that he's had this looked into and it shows that he's hypermobile, is it in all of his joints, Linda? Did they say that it's not just his shoulder, but he has looseness everywhere?
I think so, and they had a name for it. But
Ehlers-Danlos?
Pardon me?
Ehlers-Danlos?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So he probably has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, probably the hypermobility type.
Right. So there are several different types of Ehlers-Danlos, and so I expect the first thing is they're screening him for other conditions. They should be screening his cardiac and vascular systems, because those are different subtypes of Ehlers-Danlos. So that's usually the first step, is ruling out some of those other subtypes. And then if they land on simply musculoskeletal hypermobile, there are also a number of associated comorbidities with that, such as postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. There are GI disturbances with that. So he should be screened for all those things as a first step. Thereafter, he needs a good physical therapist who understands this problem, because you can't throw your garden variety strengthening program at these people and have them be successful. So I would look for somebody in your area that understands Ehlers-Danlos, and I would just continue to call around until I found somebody. Often the response will be, well, all of our staff can treat these things, and they can, but you really need to have an understanding of this in order to treat him successfully over the course of his lifetime.
Exactly. That's exactly the point I was going to make. This isn't a condition that's going to go away. This is a condition that your grandson needs to learn how to successfully manage throughout his life, to make sure that his joints are well preserved and they're not fatigued, and so he can find activities that fit his lifestyle. So it won't just be a quick fix.
Right. And if it is truly Ehlers-Danlos, that's a heritable condition. So I'd look at the people around him as well.
Yeah. Does that help, Linda?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at bruising, for one thing, and all kinds of physical therapy issues with our two guests today, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Dave Potratz, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, talking with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Both extraordinary physical therapists.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, you are. They've been with us many a time here on the show to talk about all kinds of physical therapy issues. We've taken up bruising as well as a topic today. And we're going to go back to the phones. And Rich in Madison has something, I think, relating to bruising. So let's go there. Hi, Rich. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Back in late April last year, I got a pretty severe hematoma on my shin with bruising below it. And it resolved pretty well, but left a bump behind for a number of months. And then in late August, it got extremely painful, and I guess I got diagnosed with probable compartment syndrome, which resolved itself relatively quickly.
Good.
And it's been fine up until about a week and a half ago. I mountain bike kind of regularly, and I fell on the ice. And it didn't really hurt when I fell, but that same spot is hurting again. And the lump from the hematoma never really disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no bruising right now. It's possibly lightly bruised, but that lump is extremely tender. Like walking around everyday life, there's no issues. But if pulling on a sock over it, or it being touched or brushing against something, extremely tender.
So, were you diagnosed with anterior compartment syndrome, or do you know what compartment it was?
So they didn't even know for sure that it was compartment syndrome, but that was their best guess, and that resolved itself within 50 hours.
So compartment syndrome doesn't resolve itself generally in 15 hours.
Right.
Were you having symptoms in your foot, tingling, or anything like that?
50 hours, like 2 days or so. It was in my shin.
Yeah,
it was the worst pain I've ever experienced in my life.
It could still be chronic exertional compartment syndrome and related to exertion or activity. The million-dollar question is, have you seen a physical therapist?
No, I have not.
So I think it would definitely be worth seeing a physical therapist for this, to see, number one, kind of get pinpoint what that very tender spot exactly is. And then to see if your symptoms are truly related to compartment syndrome, and there are some treatment strategies that can work to alleviate it, especially if it's more that exertional compartment syndrome that we talked about, that only comes on when you do a certain activity or certain movement repeatedly over and over. But I think it would be helpful. It sounds like you want to be active, and I think seeing a physical therapist who probably specializes in lower leg, ankle, foot would be a good strategy for you.
Right. And given the hematoma that you had there, there's a good chance that there's scar there,
right?
Because the muscles in your calves are held in these really thick fascial compartments that don't give you a lot of latitude for extra fluid or anything else. It's possible that some of that fluid is just trapped in there, and whenever you hit it, you set off some of the nerve receptors in there,
right?
And it's really painful. So you need to see somebody and try to resolve this, because I think it's going to continue to haunt you.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Until it's completely resolved.
Good luck, Rich. Thank you very much for calling. And Ruth in Altoona, we turn to you next. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. My issue is maybe somewhat similar, but not exactly. I dropped a very heavy cement object on my left foot.
Oh, that
happens.
About a year and a half ago. And I went into urgent care right away because it swelled up so badly and was so painful. And then they told me to ice it. They didn't tell me to do any follow-up, so I just kept icing it until, and I put myself on crutches and because I just could not wait there. And I just kept dealing with it myself by icing it. But it's been a year and a half, and that foot, although looks okay, I can feel where that impact happened. And there are certain shoes I just cannot wear, and there's only a certain amount of activity I can do, which is fairly good, but it'll start to give me trouble. And at night, when I'm in my bed sheets, I can feel that pressure in that area. It doesn't keep me from sleeping. I just move it so that, but what follow-up could I do with this foot?
So did you get x-rays at the time?
Yes, they okay. said that I didn't have any broken bones.
Okay. I would go back and follow up. I would see a physical therapist. You can see your primary care physician. So start with A. Sometimes x-rays can miss a fracture the first time around, depending upon the way the views were taken and how much swelling is there. Where on your foot is this approximately? Is it like the midfoot, the middle, closer to your toes?
It's on the top. On the top, right. Above my toes, below my ankle, to the left side of my left foot.
Okay.
From the top to side.
Yeah, so you could also have, if it was a heavy object, a midfoot sprain,
right.
Which is a really difficult thing to treat.
Absolutely.
It doesn't resolve easily. So I would see a physical therapist and have them evaluate your foot for the residual of that injury, and it could very well be a midfoot issue.
Right, that's what my guess is. It's a Lisfranc issue.
Yeah.
That's that midfoot joint is called that. And even if your x-rays were normal, you could have that force or that load could have been enough to sprain your ligaments, and that joint is held together by a lot of ligaments. So it could be that you need to be positioned just appropriately to kind of let those ligaments stabilize and heal. The fact that you said there were certain shoes you could not wear makes me think that that's forcing load into that joint that joint can't handle. So definitely seeing a physical therapist who specializes in the lower quarter would be a great strategy for you.
What would they do? What would a physical therapist do in that?
Go ahead.
There's a lot of intrinsic strengthening you can do. So there's a lot of very small muscles you can do that can offer dynamic stability to that joint. Mm-hmm. And it may be that you need to position that joint, kind of almost immobilize that joint a little bit to allow things to shorten up and heal a little bit. It may be that an off-the-shelf orthotic might be helpful for her. Those are kind of that would be the first line of defense. The other thing is if she's loading that joint too much, the question is, can we steal motion from an adjacent joint so she can kind of distribute that load a little bit more evenly?
So a physical therapist would help
absolutely.
With that.
Yep. Right.
Okay. Ruth, does that help?
Yeah, what's it called? What's that joint called?
Oh, Liz, L-I-S, Franc, F-R-A-N-C. But it's the tarsometatarsal joint
right.
is the real word for it.
All right.
They call it the midfoot.
Yeah.
Midfoot. There
midfoot.
You go, Ruth. Thank you very much. And Virgil in Caffin, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Virgil.
Hi, yeah. I'm just calling. I've got, I work at a grocery store, so I'm on my feet all the time. But I have this pain in my knee, and I go up and down on the floors kind of a lot, too, like Stockton and stuff. Well, I've got this pain in my knee that I don't remember ever having, trauma to my knee, mm-hmm. like a bow
right.
to the knee, like a ACL or anything. But I don't have any bruising or anything, but I was listening earlier, and the way you guys were talking about bone on bone after like an ACL or something, I mean, I can just touch my knee and I have a pain. I have a dull pain in my knee all the time.
Okay. Is it more by your kneecap, Virgil? Can you tell me exactly where on your knee it is?
It's on the inside of my knee.
Okay.
On the inside part of my knee.
Okay.
And often when I'm sitting, I feel like I've got to move my knee because I'm afraid it's going to lock up.
Okay. So it sounds to me like does it feel like it's deep within the joint?
Yeah, like I can put my thumb on it and move my thumb around on my knee, and then when I touch that one point, it's like a dull pain there, right there, all the time.
Okay. All right. Well, it definitely, especially without a mechanism of injury, it could be job-related due to the fact that you're up and down off the floor all the time and the fact that you walk around on hard concrete all day. So it definitely would be worth seeing a physical therapist to see if they can get to the pinpoint problem of this. It's probably not a bone bruise because you didn't, like you said, you didn't have that high velocity or mechanism of injury, but there are other pathology. It could be an irritation of your meniscus. You have a fat pad over on that side that could be irritated. There's a whole bunch of tendons that merge together and become your pes anserine bursa. So there's a bursa in that area. So seeing a physical therapist and have it examined and put you on a good program would be helpful.
Sounded like a meniscus to me.
Yeah, I know. Well, I know. You thought, I know that's what you were thinking, Larry.
There are a lot of suspects in that area. So that's, sometimes, you say, well, why see a physical therapist? Well, because we don't want to say, oh, this is what we think it is. Sometimes it's pretty clear what it is, but other times when it's dull pain, and as a general rule, when pain is more dull and deeper and hard to localize, it's a lot harder to find the source of that problem. So sometimes someone has to go through a number of tests to isolate and figure out exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm. All right, there you go, Virgil. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Karen emailed wondering if you could explain... Is it
erythema nodosum?
Nodosum. She has had a bruise on the lower left shin for a long time. She doesn't take any medication. It's not painful, but it's tender to deep rubbing.
Well,
what is that?
This is a type of skin inflammation that's part of the fatty layer of your skin underneath the superficial layer. And it results in these sort of reddish and tender lumps that are most often below the knees along the shin, which is where she's having this symptom. They can go away on their own. I'm wondering if she self-diagnosed this or if she saw somebody for it. But they can last for weeks to months. Sometimes they go away on their own. They can show up without any underlying disease. But there are other medical conditions that are linked with this that you should know about. Some medications can be associated with producing these, like sulfa drugs or some estrogens. It's also associated with strep throat or streptococcal infections, infectious mononucleosis, sarcoidosis, Crohn's disease, some other things that can cause these symptoms. So generally, your physician will diagnose these and you can treat them with an anti-inflammatory medication or local or systemic cortisone. So, I assume that Karen has seen somebody to get this diagnosis, but if she hasn't, she should check in probably with her primary care physician to go over any recent illnesses. Sometimes these things are the first sign of an underlying illness that they might not be aware of. So that's why it's good to check in with your doctor and say, hey, I've noticed this, and they may have some questions for you to rule out this is the first symptom of another problem. And then otherwise, to work with your physician and any kind of treatment for it.
Yeah, makes good sense. Well, Mark in Plymouth has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Yes, thank you. July 1st, I flew off a bike. I broke my femur. I then had a new ball joint put in my hip. Went through the whole series of physical therapies through Medicare. And then... at the end of it, the physical therapist said that I might be getting some tendonitis. She couldn't say that being a professionally. But anyway, so the last 2 months I've had this tendonitis. I'm wondering what I should do. It doesn't seem to go away.
Which tendon? Like, where is your pain, Mark?
Okay, it's kind of between, I would say, the upper hip and my crotch.
In the front.
In the front. On the right side of my hip is where the ball joint and where that was all operated on. But this kind of travels from there to the inside of my leg.
Do you know when you had your hip replaced, was it an anterior approach or a lateral?
I'm not sure the difference.
What are your restrictions? What are your hip restrictions?
I didn't receive any, but it was the partial hip. It wasn't the whole thing.
Oh, so it was a hemiarthroplasty. Okay, all right. So you got a new ball and sock. You got a new ball, but not a new socket.
Right.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So what kind of things bring on this pain?
Putting my leg out straight on a hassock, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes just twisting a little bit.
Okay.
As I'm standing, or sometimes bending over.
Sounds like a hip impingement syndrome to me.
It does.
Not so much of a, because it sounds positional. It sounds like when you get in a certain position, you get pain. Because when you're sitting with your leg out on the hammock, your muscles are not working.
Right.
So it sounds like it's more related to the position you're in than to the actual movement. So if it's an impingement, then we really work on stretching and mobilizing your hip.
Right, exactly.
So which would send you back to physical therapy.
Right, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
I assume you had some follow-up with your surgeon and so on.
Yes.
And I would go back to physical therapy, and I would look at potentially a new diagnosis, because you've used all your Medicare visits for like a post hip replacement, but this could be something more along the lines of a hip impingement syndrome.
Right.
That would be treated slightly differently than what you received as your post-op for your hip replacement. That's probably where I'd go, and I would start with that.
Yeah, I agree.
That help, Mark?
So I go to the primary doctor and get him to recommend.
Right, right. Your conditions are not, I don't think the condition is, it's a new episode of care per se. It sounds to me like this is something different. And per Medicare, you need a physician's referral. But in the state of Wisconsin, we do have direct access, and so by law, you do not need a referral to see a physical therapist in your situation.
So if the physical therapist you see is direct access, if their establishment has direct access, you can see the physical therapist directly, and they have to have, the physician has to sign off on the plan of care before the therapist can actually treat you, but the therapist can evaluate you. All that being said, the easiest route is to get a referral from your primary.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There you go. Thank you, Mark. Good luck. Appreciate it. And Nancy in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I am an 86-year-old Caucasian woman. I had both of my knees replaced about 19 years ago. And about a year ago, a physician told me that I had passed over from osteopenia directly into osteoporosis, and it was really quite advanced. And she sounded as if I should wrap myself in a quilt and stir again the rest of my life. But last week, I fell in my own living room because I was trying to step over a vacuum cleaner and tripped
mm-hmm.
on it.
Yeah.
I took a really hard fall and got a lot of bruises. And because of my knee replacements, I found that I could not actually get up again. So I hitched. Now, where I fell was about 35 feet from a door that would open into a short flight of stairs. So I just hitched myself on my seat until I got to this door, and just let my, and when I got to it, I opened it and just let my legs fall down and got up and walked. I have not had any pain since, although I do have bruises.
Right, right.
So I'm thinking that she tried to demonstrate to me what osteoporosis can really do to a person, and it sounded as if she meant that if I took a fall, I could expect to have a hip fracture and perhaps die in a nursing home. And I really had a very successful outcome from this fall.
Yes, you did.
Are you pretty active, Nancy?
No, I'm not. I'm actually quite sludge-like.
Well, you have defied the odds then.
Yes, exactly.
But I do drink a lot of whey protein powder.
Okay.
And I drink a lot of milk and cottage cheese and yogurt. I really like dairy food.
All right.
So I'm thinking that perhaps my ingestion of all of this protein and calcium over the years has, even though I have osteoporosis, maybe I'm an exception to all of this.
That could be. So a couple things about your situation, Nancy, as well as for other listeners. The ability to get down and up off the floor is a very good predictor of frailty and your need for medical services. So if you cannot get down and up off the floor, it would behoove you to work with somebody who can help teach you how to do that. So in your home, as you suggested, you have options. You can scoot to a piece of furniture, or as you did, you scooted to a set of stairs and stood right up. That was dynamite. The problem is if you fall outside and you don't have that option. So being able to have to utilize a strategy to get back up if you fall is really important. And your doctor is correct that a fall in the elderly with a hip fracture does have a high
mortality
incidence
rate.
Of mortality.
Within the first year, I believe.
Within the first year, exactly. So congratulations to you for defying that. But for others...
are you saying that even with artificial knees, I should be able to kneel on my knees to get up again?
I don't know if you can kneel on your knees. I know that many people with knee replacements don't like to kneel on them. So are you gonna go and kneel on them, you know, in services, you know, on the weekends? Probably not, but can you kneel on them long enough to get up off the floor?
Right.
Is a different situation in an emergency situation.
Right. And if you do have difficulty kneeling or can't kneel, then the other option is having really good upper body strength so you can push yourself up. So we'll have people who will have a small step stool and they'll transition from the floor onto the step stool with their butt. And then the next step is from that step stool up onto a couch or a sofa or something like that. But that takes a fair amount of upper body strength. So those are all things you need to be aware of, I guess.
Yep.
I hope that helps, Nancy.
Where will I go to get this training?
A physical therapist would be a good place to start. And sometimes you're in Milwaukee. I would look around and call the hospital. So, for example, here in Madison, we have physical therapists who teach classes to the general public on falls and fall prevention and getting back up off the floor should you fall.
Right.
So there may be free community classes if you look around.
Right. Yeah, Falls Clinic would be the first way to go for Nancy.
Yeah.
All right. Good luck, Nancy. Thank you so much for calling. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guest today as we talk physical therapy with them. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us. Have some open lines. We can get you on fairly quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Mary and Madison will turn to you next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My condition started with lower back pain in the left side. It felt as though I just couldn't release the muscles, the back on the left side. I've had 10 sessions of physical therapy. They haven't been able to pinpoint what it is or what the cause is. Initially thought it was sciatica because the pain would go down the left side, and it's a burning, stinging pain that would go down the left side of my thigh to about my knee. Now, at the end, they thought, well, maybe it really is caused by the back. But during this time, I traveled for 3 weeks, and then at another time, I took care of grandchildren for 2 weeks. So I wasn't able to exercise during that time. Now I've returned to my walking daily and deep water aerobics, and I'm finding that the pain is now coming back with those activities. They're suggesting possibly I have an MRI or I take gabapentin for nerve pain. What do you think could be causing this, and would an MRI be helpful?
So is it always worse? Is it worse after you walk in particular, Mary, versus the water aerobics? I know it's a hard question. That's okay. Let me ask you this. When you sit, does your do your symptoms go away?
Sometimes.
Okay. So what brings on the pain down your leg to the back of your knee?
Mostly it seems with the walking and the water aerobics.
Okay.
Standing seems to be a good position to be in. And they also suggested that, for example, I go lay on my stomach when I'm having back pain to off-lift the back.
And how does that feel?
That feels good.
Okay. So I would, and they've ruled out the anything
joint.
Primarily from your sacroiliac joint.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I think it would be reasonable to get an MRI at this point. Your symptoms don't follow any specific
right.
pattern, so I think getting an MRI to see what's going on and help direct your treatment a little bit better, because you've had 10 PT sessions, and it sounds as though the PT has considered sciatica and your low
right.
back as the source of pain. And it still hasn't gotten better.
Right.
Did it get better after the 10 sessions? Then you said you
no.
left for 3 weeks.
No.
No,
it didn't. Okay.
No.
Yeah, then I'd probably go that direction and see if that can help direct the next step of your treatment rather than
right.
kind of throwing another intervention at it
right.
like gabapentin and
right.
see if that solves the problem. The other thing to think about in the meantime is when you're walking, shorten up your stride. Sometimes the long stride can be a problem. You can think about using walking poles. Sometimes that helps people stay in a more upright position. And in your water aerobics, again, try to shorten up the stride and the intensity of what you're doing. Keep things a little bit smaller and see if that helps, because the bigger the movement, particularly in your legs, the more it loads your spine.
All right. There we go. Good luck, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Erin emailed that she has what's probably bone bruises on the bottom of her feet from very hard-soled shoes that she no longer wears, by the way.
That's good
yeah,
choice.
Yeah, it's been going on for about 3 months. She feels it when she walks, and it impacts her gait. Any tips beyond ice?
Yeah, so there are some fat pads on the plantar aspect or the bottom of your foot that are around your heel, and they're supportive, and they act like a cushion. And it could be that she kind of irritated those fat pads a little bit. And what can happen is when we land on our heel, the fat pads can actually kind of slide out to the side a little bit, and they don't stay under our heel where they can give us good support. So she may want to try something called a heel cup. It kind of just pushes the fat pads back in, and I think you can get them at any Walgreens or any drugstore, and they're called heel pad.
Mm-hmm.
Heel cups.
And if she has point tenderness in one spot underneath her heel rather than a more diffuse pain, there are other types of heel cups that are viscoelastic.
Right.
They're sort of clear, and they'll have a blue blob generally right where your sore spot is. So if she's got really isolated pain in one spot, that's another type of heel cup that she could try, the viscoelastic.
Ashley emailed, sent a photo of her legs as well. She has unexplained bruises on her legs, mild bruises from the look of them.
Mm-hmm.
She's had many blood tests to see if these can be explained with no resolution. They don't hurt. She's very fair skin and was told that she just bruises easily. Is this a valid diagnosis?
Well, that's a great question. We actually talked a little bit about this because she's done everything correctly and that she sought medical attention for this, because it does seem fairly unusual that somebody would bruise so easily and so frequently. So we were both, Lori and I were both discussing, she's had some blood testing done, but does she have some fragility or weakness in her vascular system that could go with a connective tissue disorder such as Ehlers-Danlos, which we talked about a little earlier today? So if Ashley has kind of some joint looseness where she feels very hypermobile or double jointed, then I would definitely go back to my physician and kind of go down that path, thinking that the easy bruising is a symptom of a bigger, different diagnosis.
Yeah, and in general, if she's been seeing her doctor, she's had blood tests, they've looked at this. One of the things that we see often overlooked is Ehlers-Danlos, the vascular type.
Right.
And so just making sure that is ruled out would be important.
Melody in Madison will turn to you next. Hi, Melody.
I was in an automobile accident a couple of weeks ago, and the airbag in the steering wheel deployed and hit me in the sternum. I'm still having just a little bit of discomfort, especially when I'm sneezing. Mm-hmm. Just wondering if there's anything that a physical therapist might do to help, or do I just give it some more time?
Well, it's only been a couple of weeks, and we often see this type of an injury at the spine clinic. So I would continue to use my arm as you normally do. Are you a regular exerciser?
I would say no.
Okay. Thank you for your honesty.
Yeah, exactly. That's fine. I would say to continue to use your arm as you normally do, you know, reaching, making sure you reach overhead every day, opening up your chest as much as you can to stretch. You like lying on your back with your arms out to the side. We like doing sort of a snow angel on your back, those kinds of things, and see if it continues to get better. If things are not getting better, then go ahead and see somebody.
Right.
But also,
the other thing that I would do is make sure that you're breathing appropriately, because a lot of times if we kind of clench in that area, you'll do more upper respiratory breathing. So I would lay down on my back when I was doing all those beautiful snow angels Lori was talking about, and make sure that you're taking big diaphragmatic breaths and really kind of blowing your stomach up, if you will, as you inhale, and letting it sink down as you exhale. That'll help with rib expansion as well.
Mm, there we go. Good luck, Melody. Thank you. Karen in Oconomowoc, hello to you.
Hello. About 5 weeks ago, I fell off a 3-step ladder. I was standing on the top of it, right face first onto a concrete floor with a big crack next to my right eye.
Oh.
I went through all of the bruising cycles, the purple, the green, all that. I still have a lump and a pain right next to my eye. Can't lay on that side. You know, if that is a bone bruise, about how long might I expect to suffer from that until it finally goes away?
Well, so a bone...
It was quite a loud crack when I hit that concrete floor.
I'm sure it was. Well, a bone bruise doesn't necessarily have a lump associated with it. I feel like the lumps are a little bit more associated with actually the soft tissue bruising we see, where you kind of lay down some scar tissue. So I don't necessarily think that this is a bone bruise, Karen, as much as you have some scar tissue that's probably pooled in the soft tissue around your eye. So that would be my first thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you have, for example, bruising or bleeding that is trapped in a small space, it can turn to scar. It can even ossify in some cases, mm-hmm. and you will remain with a bump there, not unlike Rich, who had the bump on his shin earlier.
Right, correct.
When that fluid gets trapped in a small space, so is it? It's still painful.
It looks different now.
Yeah.
And have you seen, I assume you saw somebody for this and they ruled out?
No, I did not, no.
Okay, well,
I just whimpered a little bit and got up, and
okay.
My face swelled up.
Okay, well, just realize that you can fracture some of the facial bones in that area. So if you're really having a lot of pain, you should see somebody and rule that out.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Sandy emailed, wondered about bone bruises. She fell and landed on her right elbow. It still hurts. This is October 29th. Do bone bruises typically last a long time?
Yes, they can last that long. And if you think about the elbow, there's so little protection.
Yeah, there's nothing there.
Correct, at the bone, that the slightest bump or irritation can really bother that periosteum. So it can take a long time. As long as it's a dull ache and she's not having any sharp focal pain where she's concerned she has a fracture, sounds like it's probably a bone bruise, and it will just take some time to heal.
So a sharp pain could be a sign of a fracture.
And very focal, exquisite pain.
Yeah.
Or inability to move her elbow and forearm.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. We are talking today with Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW's Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues. Mari and Donna, we'll get to you. Mari in Milwaukee, Donna in Luck. And there's a line open for you, too. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email, even a photo as well, at ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my two guests today, Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Jill's an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW. And they are here to answer your questions about physical therapy. So I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Mari in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Let's go to you now. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I'm 68 years old. My doctors have recommended weight-bearing exercises for osteoporosis, but they're never very specific. So I'm wondering if you could suggest specific exercises, especially for the femoral neck.
Oh, yeah. Well, walking is fabulous. So if your balance is good, walking is a great strategy. So femoral neck, low back responds very, very favorably to walking or any upright weight-bearing movements, ballroom dance.
So that being said, yes, ballroom dance. So here's the thing about walking. So I see many people who walk and say, I'm walking for my osteoporosis. But the problem is they're applying the same loads to their bones in the same range of motion at the same intensity over and over again. And that does not give you the global increase in bone strength that you need. What you need are what they call odd loads, and those are the loads that you don't do every day of your life. So if you're going to walk, you have to walk backwards, and you have to walk sideways, and you have to grapevine. Something like ballroom dance is really great. The other point is if you can do it, more impact.
Right.
So the amount of impact when you're walking it's not great. So if you can do anything that has a little bit more impact, whether it's some hopping or something like that, that's also great. So bunny hop.
Yeah, right. So some two-footed hopping side to side kind of in a very controlled environment would be great. The other way to load multiplanarly is through something like Tai Chi. And even though you're not moving your feet as much when you do that, you're still rotating, shifting, and using your muscles differently, which helps. There are a lot of studies out there that look at resistance resistance training, and is resistance training helpful for bone loss? And it is, but it's exponentially better when it's combined with a weight-bearing activity. So to do some sort of weight-bearing activity and combine it with a resistance training program a couple times a week would actually be ideal.
So if you're looking, you mentioned your neck, if you're looking at upper back and oftentimes...
I think she was thinking femoral neck.
Femoral neck. Well, okay.
Yeah, but go ahead.
In any case, so we often see women who are forward bent in the upper back. So weightlifting, doing like rowing, is really important for the upper body and osteoporosis in the upper spine. The other thing to think about in terms of resistance training, as Jill suggested, is partially for bone building, but for me, it provides the infrastructure so that you can participate in things like walking without coming down with other problems such as back pain or hip pain or something else that is a result of the exercise that you need to do for your osteoporosis. So, you know, stretching, the Tai Chi, as Jill talked about, for balance and strengthening to keep the muscles strong so that you can participate in the weight-bearing activities you need to. It's like a four, is it a four-prong stool that is? Was that
it's
four?
It's a multi-prong stool.
Multi-prong stool. There you go.
Okay.
All right?
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Bobby in Walworth, we'll go to you next, then on to Sean.
Hello?
Hi, Bobby. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I do a lot of snowmobile riding.
Okay.
And from my knees to my hips, they hurt really bad. Is there any kind of stretching I can do for that?
So this happens only after you've been riding your snowmobile?
Yeah, we ride about 200 to 300 miles a time.
Oh.
What position are your knees bent, or are your legs more straight out?
Well, there's sometimes they're bent and sometimes I have to stand up because their trails are rough.
Okay. So, you know, like riding in a car, you shouldn't be riding for that many miles at once without getting up and moving. So joints are designed to move. Muscles are designed to move. So if they stay in one position for a long time, they're going to be unhappy. So that's A. And then B is the vibration that you experience on a snowmobile is that makes your joints unhappy. Your joints don't like vibration. So it's going to make them unhappy as well. Plus, if you're on rough terrain and you're having to tighten muscles to stabilize yourself and control the snowmobile, all those things are going to take a toll on it. So in terms of keeping, reducing your pain while you're snowmobiling, stopping more often, and you can do some stretching, such as, you know, pulling your foot back towards your butt, crossing your ankle over your knee and sort of sitting down and squatting to stretch your hip, as well as doing strengthening exercises for your hips and legs when you're not on your snowmobile.
Right, absolutely. By doing some lunges or some squats, some bridging to make sure your glutes are very good and strong would be great. And then... making sure that your balance is really good too by doing some sort of balance exercises, whether it's standing with your eyes closed or doing some weight shifting, because if you have to stand up to control your snowmobile and you're probably shifting your body weight side to side, you'd need a lot of balance kind of in that frontal plane per se. So even some sidestepping with the band around your feet would probably be something very good for you.
So those things are going to help, but, you know, depending upon your age and overall physical condition, just being on a snowmobile for that length of time, I'm not sure there's a lot you can do to offset that unless you stop more frequently and move around.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Bobby. Appreciate the call. And Sean in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Sean.
Hi there, Larry and your two guests. Appreciate your time today. I'm sure the screener kind of informed you, but my wife, I've been diagnosed a little over 3 years ago with RSD, or what is known as CRPS, complex regional pain, neurological disorder. Initially, she had gone through the physical therapy to avoid the dystrophy that would
Yeah, what body part?
It would be her dominant right hand.
Dominant right hand. Okay. Has she done mirror therapy, like box therapy?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, so it sounds like, you know, that would be a good screener question for, does the person really know how to treat this? So that's
right.
So
right.
It sounds like she's gotten the therapy that she needs. Have they talked about sympathetic blocks and she's been through all that?
We do the stellate ganglion. Yeah. The only thing that seems to help is we've done the lidocaine infusion. We've been down to Madison for UW Health for that infusion. Ketamine seems to be the only anesthetic that keeps in her system long enough. We're finally with a pain specialist now that's going to be, again, treating us with that. Once that is in her system and she can have more movement with the syndrome, as you may know, it can travel through other parts of the body.
Right. Right.
And she's worried about, she's felt it now in her right shoulder, so it may move and go to other parts. When she does get this block, and really the block doesn't do anything, it's actually just the anesthetic that's used during the block that helps her. When she does have that, hopefully she does find some relief. Are there any sort of therapy or stretches or ways? I mean, I know that she's probably guarded to her torso with her right hand.
Right.
Has she tried any like light compression garments? Has she done the whole gamut on compression garments to her with her hand and arms?
It's sensitive to the touch.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Has she been in a pool at all? Can she tolerate that?
Pool has seemed to help somewhat. Although we have two small children, so this happens right after our second was born, so she's much.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I guess that's where, you know, she's going to need help and support to perhaps help care for the children so she can go to the pool on her own and do some activities, because as you suggested, this issue of it traveling other places is an issue. In terms of her shoulder, it's hard to tell if it's the CRPS affecting her shoulder or if it's the splinting and guarding. So
right.
If she can function in a pool, getting in there on a regular basis so she can keep the rest of her body healthy and keep this isolated to a hand, I guess that would be the best advice that I can offer, is
right.
that she's got to keep everything else healthy, and she's going to need, you know, her village around her helping her so that she can take care of herself and be available to help take care of others.
Question for you. How long would she ideally be in a pool at one time, and how often, per week or what?
It depends upon what she can tolerate. So I've had people that can't tolerate more than 5 minutes because of the pressure in the water. There are other people who will stay for up to an hour in it. It's a very, very individual situation.
Would you start, Lori, if she's having difficulty if she is so sensitive, would you start her at home with just small bouts in water where there's less hydrostatic pressure? Do you not think that's that helpful experience?
What I would do is if she was having difficulty even tolerating the water, I would have her in the water with her hand out, sitting on some flotation device that she could work the rest of her body and her other arm in the water, and then gradually work towards immersion, first just in the top of the water where there's very little hydrostatic pressure, and then working to submerge it more.
Okay.
All right. Does that help, Sean?
Yeah. Thank you, Three, for all your input.
Yeah,
all
good right. luck with that. Yeah, it's a really difficult
very complicated,
situation.
Right?
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sean, for calling.
Yep.
Let's take another call. Jim and Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Thanks for taking my call. About 6 months ago, I seemed to tweak my left hip doing some housework. And I exercise regularly. I swim and I walk a lot. And just recently, it's gotten to a point where I can't sleep on my left side. I have a pain that wakes me up from my hip to my knee on the outside of the leg. If I turn over, it seems to go away. I'm just curious as to what that might be and how I should address it. Thanks.
Well, it could be some greater trochanteric bursitis. There's a very large bursa on the outside of your hip. It could also be tightness in your IT band. Your iliotibial band connects on the lateral side or outside of your hip and goes from your hip all the way down to your knee. So either of those two could be the character, the cause of your, the source of your symptoms. And then lying on those would actually cause compression or pain. So those things kind of make sense. If you haven't seen a physical therapist, I would definitely encourage you to see a physical therapist, because to know the differential diagnosis or which of those two is the pain generator would kind of dictate how your, what your course of care is going to involve, and things would be different for one versus the other. The other thing is pain kind of around your hip can also be coming from your low back. So you'd want to make sure that it's truly not coming from your low back, that you didn't do something to your low back when you did this twisting mechanism. So as active as you are, I would definitely encourage Jim to see a physical therapist, get some exercises or specific things that he can do at home to get him kind of on the right track again.
All right. Good luck, Jim. Thank you very much. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn.
Hi. I wanted to recommend a book for the woman with osteoporosis. It's by Dr. Lauren Fishman, and it's called Yoga for Osteoporosis. And it's excellent, and he also will travel throughout the country occasionally doing workshops on this, and he trains yoga teachers to use these poses. So it's a great book, and hopefully she can check it out.
So that's great.
Lauren Fishman, and it's Yoga for Osteoporosis.
Yes.
All right. Pat, thank you. Appreciate your call. And Diana emailed to say that she has severe osteoarthritis in her spine. She's been told by her surgeon at last follow-up after failed back surgery that she has no discs or facets left in her spine. She's done all she knows to do, including acupuncture and physical therapy. She can't walk or move anywhere without extreme pain. Now there's a possibility of going ahead with what she calls her last hope. It's mm-hmm. called StimWave. Have you heard of it, and how does it work?
It's a wireless pain relief symptom, sort of a neuromodulation, I think like a TENS unit. There are some units that are implanted. Mm-hmm. There are some that you wear on your skin. I don't know a lot about this one, about StimWave in particular. If it's something that her physician, who has been seeing her for her spine on an ongoing basis, has recommended, then I would talk more with my surgeon. Some of these work very well for people. Some of them don't work at all. So there's also some of these implantable devices. They go through a trial period where they put the stimulator on your skin first,
right,
and see if you respond to it before they talk about any kind of implanted device. So I would talk with my surgeon or whoever has recommended this and get information about the outcomes of this, how many people do well, what are the characteristics of the people who do well, and do I fit in that same category? Because you can go online and look up StimWave, and they'll say, oh, we have testimonials from right. these people and that people, and they're all great and everyone's happy. But it may be a very different situation than your own. So you really have to do a lot of research on that. I haven't seen anybody who's had this particular device.
Correct, me neither. But that could just be a brand that's very similar to brands that you and I have seen. So.
Right.
All right.
Right.
Things to think about. Thank you so much, Diana, for that email. Kelly in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Kelly.
Hello. Yes, the question I have is, I exercise with a friend and we mostly do Pilates. She has developed a blood clot that is from her ankle up to her groin in the right leg. And I'm just worried as to the amount of exercise that she should be doing. She's been placed on blood thinners, and they recommended light exercise. And is Pilates light enough exercise for her?
Yeah.
That's type of movement.
That's a great question. And the reason that you want that we put people on light activity or we really control that is because while you're anticoagulated and they're trying to break up that blood clot, you don't want any of those pieces to dislodge and end up in your lung.
Mm-hmm. Because you will die. If you have a pulmonary embolism, it'll kill you.
Right.
So you have to be very careful, and you're right to be concerned. And this is one of the big questions about exercise. You say Pilates. You can do Pilates gently, or you can do Pilates really vigorously. So it occurs along the continuum. It's like, well, we walk for exercise. Well, you can walk and go out for a stroll, or you can be speed walking. So when you say, well, I'm walking, I don't know how intense that is. So if your friend is doing Pilates, I would make sure that it is light, and have your friend really work closely with her physician who is managing this to make sure that what she's doing is safe, because the downside is very steep.
And exactly.
It's a one-way ticket.
Exactly. Exactly.
So there you go, Kelly. I would have a talk with your friend.
Err on the very, very, very conservative side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for that call. Maria in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Maria.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, I have essential familial tremor, and mm-hmm. it mostly affects my right hand, mm-hmm. and I'm wanting to know, are there any exercises that can help me get better control over, say, handwriting?
So that's a great question, Maria. The one suggestion would be to see if you haven't seen an occupational therapist who could better suit you with adaptive devices to make your activities of daily living a little bit easier. So they can give you pens that would be easier for you to hold, for example, and devices that you could use in your kitchen that would make things in your kitchen a little bit easier as well. So I don't know that there's exercises as much as we can give you things that would help you best fit how you are presenting right now.
Right. The exercises aren't really going to stop the tremor, but
right.
But seeing somebody to get the right tools can make you more functional.
Right.
What's the difference in training between an occupational therapist and a physical therapist?
So occupational therapists are currently at an entry-level master's program. So mm-hmm. In PT, most of the programs are an entry-level doctorate program. I think occupational therapy will eventually go there. But then our approach is a little bit different as well. A lot of occupational therapists teach more habituation type exercises, have a tendency to work a little bit more in the upper extremity, and also have a tendency to work more with patients with mental health issues. They have a bigger psychological training than physical therapists do.
And I imagine, like in workplace kinds of situations, an occupational therapist could be very helpful.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There definitely is an overlap between physical therapy and occupational therapy, but then we also both have our uniqueness too.
Well, I tell you what, here we are about out of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had another question about, is ice or heat better? We talked about that earlier in the show, and I...
Right. Well, this is a specific question from Colleen that has a systemic rheumatologic condition, and she's got stiff and painful muscles, and wondering if ice or heat is better. And in that situation, we would say whatever's comfortable. And yes, moving is better, but she is not doing damage as long as she's not creating pain.
Right.
As long as you're not creating pain, Colleen, keep that in your mind. And Lori and Jill, thank you both so much. We'll look forward to your next visit on February 18th.
Sounds great.
Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today, they'll be back on the 18th of February, and we'll do this all over again. Mary Mellum comes by tomorrow to talk taxes with us. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.